Okay, so the topic I want to deal with tonight is intermarriage, going all the way back to Bereshit and to now. And this is a topic that has been of concern for many decades and probably for decades to come. It's not something that will be overcome overnight. It's a conversation that will definitely keep going. Sort of have mitzvah of the week. So we'll discuss to what extent it even, is a deoraita or derabanan, is it a mitzvah from the Torah? If not, but definitely something that's of concern for halacha. In some ways, this conversation has resurfaced a little bit because a couple weeks ago, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris were elected to be president and vice president, respectively. Apparently, Senator Vice President Biden has a number of Jewish grandchildren. I don't know if all of his kids married Jews or a couple of them did. And then Senator Harris herself is married to a Jew. So a couple months ago, I just saw this article very recently, but apparently this was written a few months ago. So a woman named Alicia Chandler, who herself is, I think, a Jew married to a Catholic. So she went on saying that, you can't really celebrate the fact that Kamala Harris is married to a Jew, which some people, think it's, amazing that, that there's Jews on that sort of level of government. But at the same time, she's saying, Jewish community doesn't have the right to celebrate that to the extent that they turn away intermarried couples. Now, on some level, I agree that, maybe there's a little bit of sort of a mixed celebration, have nothing against, the choices of the vice president elect, and it's a free country. So this isn't meant to be accusatory about them, but obviously this woman takes in different directions. So she says, from one of the countless conversations I've had, I worried about the people who have just left, the couple who had a rabbi refused to officiate at their wedding, never walked into a synagogue again. I worried about the Jewish professional who went to his first conference, heard a speaker say that marrying somebody of another faith meant leaving the community and decided to leave the organization. At some point early in the article, she brings up the example of how people might say that people who intermarry are doing Hitler's work for him. So she bemoaned that. So she goes on this a little bit, the family who cannot find a moel to perform a bris and never end up educating their child in Judaism. And the part that breaks my heart is when I meet a non-Jew who shares with me that their mom or dad was Jewish, but their parent was forced to choose between love and religion. This person is now lost to the community forever. It's time for full inclusion of all interfaith families in the Jewish community, not just vice presidential nominees and celebrities. So this is the direction that she takes. And I want to explore how the subject of intermarriage comes up really throughout history, but starting from Tanakh, including in this week's Parsha, going all the way through. Of course, it will be clear, if it's not already, where I stand on the prohibition of intermarriage. Spoiler alert, I definitely think it's contrary to halakha. I think to have a discussion about this, we have to be honest about, what people who take views to the contrary think. We have to understand them on their own terms. So I will incorporate the thoughts of others in this, including views that I don't agree with. And the inclusion of that is not necessarily sanctioning that, but I think we should, honestly understand what's going on. But we should actually go back to last week's Parsha, to Parsha Chayei Sara, where Avram, the whole drama of the Parsha is that, Avram realizes, Sarah has died. And I don't know if that itself was the trigger, but Avraham also realizes that he is getting older. And Yitzchak is not married yet. And he's concerned that Yitzchak will marry the right person for the family. So Avraham tells his servant, he makes him swear that he will not allow Yitzchak to take a wife from the daughters of Canaan, you know, where we are, but you have to go elsewhere to take a wife for my son Yitzchak. So that's really the whole drama of this parsha. And, you know, will Rivka go along? Will she not? And then the Eved gets there, and he has super hakaras hatov to Kadosh Baruch Hu for making it, you know, so obvious who the right person is. And then they have this whole discussion. You know, he repeats the whole story of the importance of Rivka marrying Yitzchak, and you know, will she come? So that's the bulk of Parshat Chayesara. That's what we saw last week. So already, you know, I think it's worth saying. You know, you can't say this about every topic in every mitzvah, but when it comes to this issue of marriage and who's a suitable wife for somebody who is part of the Brit of Avraham Avinu, this is an issue from the start. Of course, back then, you know, obviously your options were very small, but I think that's a very significant point. Then we get to this week's parsha. So the pasuk I brought is actually the second time that intermarriage comes up. But let me read you, if I can pull it up very quickly, the first time this comes up. So the Torah tells us, Vayhi Esav ben Arba'im Shana, Esav was 40 years old. Ikach Isha et Yehudit bat Be'eri Achiti. So he takes Judith, the daughter of Be'eri, who's a Hittite. Bat Basmat bat Elon Achiti. So he takes two Hittite women. And it's, I always think it's ironic that the name of this woman is Yehudit. So obviously, you know, Yehuda was not, did not exist yet. There were no Jews yet, per se. I've always found it ironic that one of the first intermarried women was named Yehudit. And then Torah tells us, Vatihiana morat ruach liyitzak l'rivka. And they were extremely bitter about it. What's the word that the Sefaria translation uses? There were source of bitterness for Yitzchak and Rivka. And then, you know, notice actually that that what comes right after that is the whole drama of Yaakov stealing the birthright from Esav. And then right after that whole drama is when we get to Vatomer Rivka Yitzchak Kasi v'chayai, I'm disgusted with my life. Because of the Hittite women that Esav married. If Jacob marries a Hittite woman like these from among these native women, what good will my life be to me? By the way, I'm just thinking about this right now to see if anybody explores this. But it's fascinating, of course, that, you know, remember Rivka is the one who is brought to Yitzchak in order to prevent intermarriage in the first place. Maybe she really takes it personally that, you know, the whole reason why she, you know, married Yitzchak and moved to Eretz Canaan was to sort of prevent this movement. You know, maybe she's thinking to herself, you know, what did I get from this, from the whole rest of my life, you know, from marriage onwards, if this is destiny of my children. But she's obviously very, very concerned. They're very concerned about what Esav did, and she certainly doesn't want to see Yaakov do the same thing. And the difference, of course, between, let's just say, you know, Yishmael and Esav in this regard, even though, you know, Yishmael and Esav both sort of play the role of being, you know, the one who's not really part of the breed, but Yishmael is the son of Hagar. It's a little different, but Esav is even though, you know, we see Esav as being an other, he's still the son of Rivka, no less than Yaakov is. So I think that's a significant point. And again, just emphasize that, you know, the bookends of these two discussions of intermarriage is this whole thing about Yitzchak stealing, Yaakov stealing the birthright and the brachot from Esav. And I think that's probably a significant point. That's really what's driving this whole episode, is that, you know, whether, you know, next week we'll discuss a little bit about whether lying is permitted. It comes up in next week's parsha, but it's also relevant to this week's parsha. People, of course, want to know, you know, how it could be that that Yaakov cheated, and how did Rivka, you know, how did Rivka go against her husband like this? But obviously it was of colossal importance in Rivka's mind. And after Rivka, you know, says to Yitzchak, you know, what's the worth of my life if Yaakov intermarries? So then the Torah tells us, he commands him not to take a Canaanite woman. Okay, so this is an important part of the drama here. Okay, so this comes up. So this comes to Parsha Toldot. Topic of intermarriage also comes up in Sefer Ezra. Okay, so it comes up again in the Torah, you know, you could probably find in a number of places in Nach where it's a concern or not. But I want to jump to Ezra, where it says, "Uchalot ele nikshu elai asarim lemor lo nivdelu ha'am Yisrael v'kohanim v'aliyim me'amei ha'aretzot kitoavehem." So when this was over, the officers approached me, saying, "The people of Israel and the priests of Levi have not separated themselves from the people of the land, whose important practices are like those of the Kanani, the Chiti, Prisi, Visi, Amoni, Moavi, Mitzri, Hamori." Right? So people have not separated themselves from the practice. Ki nastu mibnotehem lahem ulibnehem, because they have taken their daughters as wives for themselves and for their sons. Arvu zera hakodesh b'meh haratzot, so that the holy seed has become intermingled with the people of the land. And its officers and prefects who have taken the lead in this trespass. Okay, so not only is this an indictment on the people, but it's an indictment on the leaders. Intermarriage was a big problem in the post Bayit Rishon, pre Bayit Sheni. Right, this is something that they have to fix as they come back to Eretz Yisrael. It's a big problem, and we know that that there was a lot of neglect of Tar Mitzvot in the period of Ezra and Nehemiah, to the point where they didn't even have Rosh Hashanah, and that's when they hear about Rosh Hashanah, they know they cry, they're told not to cry, it's a Yom Tov, but there was clearly a lot of neglect, and intermarriage was part of this. Okay, and Ezra continues, Vayakum Ezra Kohen Vayomar Alehem Atem Meltem V'toshivu Nashim Nochriyot Lehosif Alshman Yisrael. You have trespassed by bringing home foreign women, thus aggravating the guilt of Israel. So now make confession to the Lord, God of your fathers, and do his will, and separate yourselves from the peoples of the land and from the foreign women. So this is very direct. Ezra saying you can't stay in these marriages. You can't allow them to happen anymore. It has to stop. It was obviously the fact that it wasn't just, you know, a small percentage, a negligible percentage, but obviously of serious concern. Then Nehemiah, and also again the same time period essentially. So, namely, we will not give our daughters in marriage to peoples of the land, nor take their daughters for our sons. So that's a promise that they're making. So this is a, you know, point of tshuva that they have to have. So I think, you know, something that's important to note and understanding this conversation is that one might be tempted to say that today is different. It's so rampant. So maybe our response our whole approach to intermarriage has to be different than it was, you know, in medieval times and whatever. But I think we see ample precedent in Tanakh. Again, you know, not even looking at it from a halachic standpoint, but when we look at Tanakh and we see what the concerns were. So starting with Avraham Avinu, starting with Yitzhak, particularly Rivka, all the way through Ezra and Nehemiah, which is essentially the end of Tanakh. This is an issue of real concern, and it was clearly, you know, with Avraham and Rivka, it's preventative, but when it comes to Ezra and Nehemiah, it was actually a problem. So I think the concerns of intermarriage are not necessarily new today. I think it's something to keep in mind. So question is there a prohibition of intermarriage or and is it from the Torah? Certainly rabbinic one, and we'll see that, but is it biblical? So in Sefer Dvarim, it says, V'lo titchaten bam, you shall not intermarry with them, v'itcha lo titchen livno, v'itcha lo titchach livnecha. Okay, so sometimes, you know, we only see things go in one direction with gender. I guess in another marriage-related example is when it comes to LGBT, so it actually doesn't say anything about the L part. There's nothing about two women. Only talks about two men. But here it's actually very clear that there's no crossbreeding. It doesn't matter if it's it doesn't matter if the woman's Jewish or if the man's Jewish. This prohibition of intermarriage seems to apply. However, one thing to note is that this comes up in the context of the Shiva Amamin, that it seems to come up in the context of when you come to Eretz Yisrael and there's these seven nations that you're not supposed to associate with, you're not supposed to associate with at all. So that's something to keep in mind. So the Gemara in Avodah Zarah says, if I'm Gneva, Mishmei de Rav Amar, Gneva says the name of Rav, Kudla Mishun Avodah Kochavim Gazri Bahen. So there's a whole bunch of prohibitions that exist that are rabbinic, and the whole institution of those prohibitions is to make sure that there's no intermarriage. So, for example, might be familiar with the idea of pat akum, that one's not allowed to have bread that's baked by a Gentile. So that prohibition we've actually sort of limited in a particular way. But some people are extra strict. It says in Shulchan Aruch to be strict about this during a seri mechuvah, to only have bread that's baked by a Jew. But stam yinam is something that's still a particularly relevant. Okay, not having wine that was handled or opened or produced by a non-Jew. So that is a serious prohibition, and that's why we have the concern of mevushal. So if it's mevushal, so again, that sort of helps us with the issue. But if it's not mevushal, so the prohibition applies. And the whole reason for these institutions is because the concern was of socialization, right? Of intermingling, right? So the Gemara says, "V'algina mishum b'notehen." The reason why they prohibited wine was in order to prevent intermarriage. And the prohibition of intermarrying is because of something else, namely Avodah Zarah, and Avodah Zarah because of something else, etc. Without going too much into the details, here's a point to understand is that if Jews and non-Jews are socializing, drinking together, so that creates familiarity, that creates friendliness, which in, on some level, I think it's not that all relationships are bad. I think we believe that there are some positive relationships between Jews and non-Jews, but to the point where it leads to possibility of marriage was a concern. And ironically, I think some parts of the communities of the Jewish community that sort of dispense with these prohibitions, saying that the idea of non-Jew cooking for you isn't a problem, and we don't worry about Stam Yenam. So those are communities where intermarriage is a little bit more of a problem. So I think there's something to be said for that. Think about it this way. When I was in college, I went to what we would call a secular college. It was not the Yeshiva University or Torah or anything like that. So it's somewhat of a concern. It's somewhat of a concern to be in that sort of open environment. But with that said, I was grounded in a Hillel where we went to davening daven three times a day there. Kosher food was provided there. So all of that sort of, anchors the observant students in that particular environment. That's where the social environment is. But if you decide, to go to the bars and hang out with anybody, or or you go to the diner and eat with anybody, and there's no problem putting other kosher concerns aside. There's no problem, you know, eating those places. So that's where, you know, socialization happens, that, you know, that naturally sort of leads to that. So that's exactly what the Gemara is trying to prohibit it. And the Gemara suggests that intermarriage is prohibited, dichtiv lo titchat tenbam, because you're not supposed to intermarry with them. So the possibility is raised that, no, really, from the Torah, that only applies to the seven nations that exist in Eretz Canaan at the end. So one opinion in the Gemara is that prohibition of Lotit Chaten Bam really only applies to the seven nations, but any other non-Jews are only, you know, these matters are only prohibited rabbinically, but not biblically. So Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai comes along and says, for he will turn away your son from following me. So that's a concern of intermarriage. So he thinks that Loti Tichaten Bam is actually, you know, that there's a prohibition of marrying somebody who's not Jewish from the Torah. And the rabbis came to include other forms of sexual relationships, but this is from the Torah. Now, it actually it comes up that the prohibition of having a sexual relationship with a non-Jew comes from Breishit, where Tamar gets pregnant, and they don't initially know who it was. And when Yehuda says to bring her to burn, so they're thinking that maybe that she slept with a Gentile, and she was already part of the family, so she wasn't allowed to do that. And this was a prohibition that came from the Beit Din of Shame. So that's something that also comes up in Sefer Breishit, in the next generation after Yaakov, or I guess a generation after, really. So the Gemara grapples with is, you know, is marriage technically a biblical prohibition or a rabbinic prohibition? Now, the, where is the Rambam? I didn't bring the Rambam. So actually, I'll jump to the Shulchan Aruch first and then to the Torah. So the Shulchan Aruch says that, and he's quoting the Rambam here, that a Jew that has relations with a non-Jew, derech ishut, as a means of marriage, right? So not just as like a one-night stand kind of situation, but like, you know, as part of a real marital relationship, and vice versa, right? If a Jewish woman with a non-Jewish man, you know, so these individuals get lashes from the Torah because of the verse Lotit Chaten Bam. So that is the Rambam's approach that's quoted by Shulchan Aruch. Now, the Rambam notes that there's some who disagree with this, and this goes back to the Torah and really to the Gemara, because there's opinion of Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai who said that intermarriage is an Isser Doraita, but the Torah says that that's not actually biblically mandated, but it's actually rabbinically mandated. So there's some who think that, you know, that it's technically that actual marriage is rabbinically mandated. And part of the problem here also is that how do we define marriage in halacha? So if marriage takes the form of halacha of kiddushin, so kiddushin doesn't work with non-Jews. So it's might technically be impossible to be married, which is why the Rambam says that that if, you know, if the intercourse is in a, you know, marriage context, but nonetheless, so that's sort of left up to debate whether marriage is technically prohibited from the Torah. But all would seem to agree that that this is certainly at least a rabbinic prohibition, and certainly also goes against the spirit. Again, everything we've seen in Breishit and in Ezra and Nehemiah goes against certainly the spirit of the Torah. The Shulchan Aruch further notes that technically speaking, that if one does kiddushin, it's technically it's nothing. But at the same time, the form of marriage is certainly problematic. Now, that's what we get in Poskim. When I was studying for my comprehensive exam in medieval Jewish history, which I had to take in order to get my master's degree, I had a number of books I had to read just leading up to the exam, sort of outside of any courses. And I remembered coming across, actually, some of these sources I put together a couple years ago, but I remember coming across a couple places where the type of intermarriage actually came up in the medieval context. So one of these examples was in the a book by a historian named Jonathan Ray, who's an expert on Spain and the Inquisition and the like. So he wrote a book called The Sephardic Frontier, the Reconquista and the Jewish Community in Medieval Iberia. So he writes, as can be seen in the legislation regarding Jewish dress, one of the greatest fears of both Christians and Jews regarding their social interaction was the potential for sexual relations between members of different faiths. Okay, so it's interesting at the time that this was sort of a mutual concern, and note that in America today, obviously, the concern's a little bit more one-sided. And then it goes on to say, intercourse between Jews and Christians has been prohibited since antiquity. Laws forbidding the practice can be found throughout the royal charters of medieval Iberia. For cases in which Jewish men were convicted of having intercourse with Christian women, the fueros ordered that both were to be put to death, often by being burned alive. So that's harsher than the Torah prohibition, but that's what the law in Spain was. But that speaks to the concern when it came to Jewish-Christian intermarriage. Another historian, Mark Cohen, who wrote a book called Under Crescent and Cross, the Jews in the Middle Ages. So that's a little bit broader, focusing on both Christian and Muslim societies. But he writes the following: intermarriage between Jews and non-Jews existed as a theoretical possibility in both Islamic and European Christian society. Judaism and Christianity forbade this ultimate form of sociability. Islam handled the matter more indulgently. With Quranic sanction, it allowed the marriage of a Muslim man to a dhimmi woman, on the presumption that as a master in the relationship, the Muslim husband would not be susceptible to the lore of his wife's religion. Now, he goes on to say remarkably, and this is truly is remarkably, Islamic law requires that the husband to permit his non-Muslim wife to observe her religious rituals and to pray inside their house, and it admonishes him not to prompt her, if she's Jewish, to break the Sabbath or to eat forbidden foods. So just imagine this: intermarriage with the wife remaining from, she keeps Shabbos and she keeps kosher, but she's married to a non-Jew. So that's not the intermarriage that we know of today. I don't know how widespread this was, but it's obviously widespread enough that it was worth commenting on. So again, I think if we're going to talk about sort of historical precedents, and if we want to say that today, is different, and because it's so rampant, then maybe we have to be more accommodating. So I think, first of all, the topic of intermarriage is not new at all. Something that comes up in Tanakh, in the Gemara, comes up in the Middle Ages, and not just because the Rambam and Shulchan Aruch just happened to pass and everything that comes up in the Gemara, but because it was, this stuff actually really did happen. Obviously, not as widespread as it is today, but it happened, and presumably, right, this is the important part, obviously, presumably, Halacha never changed just because people were doing it. Okay. So now let's look at what the situation is today. So stuff is already actually starting to get a little bit dated at some point or another. If I talk about this again, I'll have to look at to see if there's more current material. But the classic survey that's, I think, still on the minds of many was a essential survey that was done by the Pew Research Center. It sort of remained at the center of discourse. I think even today it's still very much part of discourse. And for those of you who have screens, so you can see the graphs here. You know, back in the day, before 1970, so in America, 83% of Jews were unmarried. That has dropped in 40-something years to 42%. So it's, you know, literally in half. And that's just among all Jews. But there's also, you know, the Pew Report distinguishes between Jews by religion versus Jews who are just Jews because, you know, their mother or their parent is Jewish or whatever, but don't necessarily identify with Judaism as a religion. So if you identify by Jew as a religion, so that number is higher. So before 1970, it's astounding, 89% married a Jewish before 1970. 2013, it's 55%, which is still better than 42%, but still a remarkably low number, a significant drop. How does this go by denomination? So among Jews, percentage whose spouse is Jewish, so for Jews overall, so here they have it as 56%. So 98% of Orthodox Jews are, that's an astounding number, especially if you want to talk about how this is a nationwide trend. 98% of people who identify as Orthodox are married to a Jew. With conservative, 2013, it was 73%, which is still an impressive number overall. Reform, it drops to 50. And very significantly, no denomination is 31%. So I think this description of the Pew Report here is a new Pew Research survey finds that overall 56% of married Jews have a Jewish spouse, while 44% of Jewish respondents are married to a non-Jew. Among Jews who are by religion who are married, 64% have a Jewish spouse. Okay, so that's a significant number. 64% of those who are Jews by religion have a Jewish spouse, and 36 have a non-Jewish spouse. By comparison, Jews of no religion are much more likely to be in mixed marriages. Just 21% of married Jews of no religion are married to a Jewish spouse. Okay, there you go. That's an alarming number. While 79% are married to a non-Jewish spouse. So it's obviously not a coincidence that one's connection to Judaism, you know, and to Torah, even if it's not, you know, strict observance of halacha, but this is obviously of central importance. Now, I just want to take a moment and look at how a couple of the denominations are approaching it, because again, obviously, we see that people who don't affiliate with Judaism as a religion are not particularly attached to the idea of marrying Jewish. But these numbers have definitely prompted a sort of crisis mode, particularly for Reform and Conservative movements, who are the ones who are the movements where perhaps not halakhically observant Jews are most affiliated with. And sure enough, it's their rabbis who have had to figure out how to deal with this. So back in 1973, the Reform Movement put out a resolution that said as follows: the Central Conference of American Rabbis, which is their version of the RCA, said that now declares its opposition to participation by its members in any ceremony which solemnizes a mixed marriage, meaning it was strongly discouraged for Reform rabbis to officiate at an intermarriage. So, and then they go on to say, recognizing that historically the CCAR encompasses members holding divergent interpretations of Jewish tradition, the conference calls upon these members who dissent from this declaration. So basically they're saying, you know, they're discouraging officiating at an intermarriage. However, if you're going to officiate an intermarriage, at least, you know, there should be some learning involved on the part of the couple. You know, if it's somebody who's a member of another synagogue, you have to talk to the rabbi first. You shouldn't share it with a non-Jewish clergy, right? So it shouldn't be a rabbi and priest officiating, and you shouldn't do it on Shabbos or Yom Tov, which again, we would take it as for granted that's halakhically prohibited, but that's what they write. As this was originally 1973, as time has gone on, so I don't necessarily know what the numbers are in terms of how many Reform rabbis will officiate an intermarriage. And I don't actually don't even remember what exactly, you know, the stance is on this particular issue. I will say that, you know, I think Hebrew Union College, which is their rabbinical school, does not admit students who are married or plan to marry non-Jews. And for some Reform Jews, that's very upsetting because, you know, they think, you know, they think that, you know, the two aren't contradictory. So it remains a point of contention. And I think, you know, Reform is trying to be sort of more accommodating and welcoming of intermarried couples, that they're perhaps starting to take the approach a little bit, if they hadn't already, that that you know, if you want people to sort of stay connected to Judaism, you have to welcome them, even if they make choices, you know, these kinds of choices. But there's still a little bit of grappling with to what extent we sanction this or not. What made waves a couple of years ago was that at the graduation of Hebrew Union College, so Michael Chabon, the famous author, wrote the following, and this was, I guess, frankly, this was upsetting. It was upsetting to read. There are actually some great responses from Orthodox rabbis. I think Rabbi Yitzchak Blau from Israel, if I remember correctly, he wrote a nice response to this. But this is what Chabon has to say. Like our parents and grandparents and many times great-grandparents before us, in other words, my wife and I married him. Okay, so he's married to a Jew. He says, leaving aside the minor consideration of my having fallen in love with her first sight, etc., it was a strange thing for me to have done. I pour homogeneity into the traditional Jewish wedding ritual, makes explicit, it draws a circle around the married couple and inscribes them within a figurative wall of tradition, custom, shared history, and a common inheritance of chromosomes and culture. I know that ghetto is a loaded word. So it says, maybe you want to call it an enclave, but you know what? I abhor an enclave to a gated community, restricted country club. Basically, he's saying that in marriage is bad. People should not marry, I guess shouldn't go out of their way to marry Jews, but, you know, it's a Western world. We should be, should be more free-spirited. We should be more integrated. We should be more diverse. And Jews and non-Jews should marry freely. So he said this at the graduation of rabbinical students at Hebrew Union College. It was a fairly controversial moment. So I share this because it's important to know that this is what's being said out there, and it's being said on mainstream stages. As we can imagine, when it comes to conservative Judaism, it becomes a little bit more complicated. JTS put out a statement a couple years ago saying that that basically they believe that in marriage is important. They write, the wedding ceremony is not only celebration of a couple, but commitment to the Jewish covenant. And it's opening blessing, thanks God for infusing our lives with holiness through the mitzvot, right? Etc. And such statements can only be said if both partners identify as Jews. And then they say, we understand the arguments made for our clergy to officiate at interfaith weddings, knowing that they come from a place of genuine concern for bringing near individuals and family who are or might be estranged from the community and tradition we love. However, we believe, and the data confirm, that by far the most effective path towards building a Jewish future is to strengthen Jewish identity, beginning with the Jewish family. This is also a path which the Torah and tradition command. So taking the stance that halakha commands Jews to marry Jews, and they're also saying that it is more effective. An article JTA notes that there was a point in time when conservative rabbis were prohibited not only from officiating interfaith marriages, but were also prohibited from attending them. So that ban has been lifted. There's also a point where I think a non-Jewish spouse could be a member, you know, a full member of a shul, and might even be allowed to, do a psicha, to open the ark. So they're also grappling with how to accommodate. But When it comes to the actual sort of involvement in the marriage itself, so there's a little bit of chafing. There are some voices in the conservative movement that that will argue that, you know, we have to be more inclusive. We have to realize that this is reality. Again, you know, we risk turning people off from Judaism and making sure and only ensuring that they that they'll stay farther away from Judaism if we reject them wholesale. There is somebody who is ordained by JTS. I think he actually specifically chose not to join their rabbinical association, their rabbinical assembly, because of his stance on intermarriage. He also happens to be a cousin, first cousin of the chief, the Ashkenazi chief rabbi of Israel. But he wrote a whole pamphlet on intermarriage and moving towards creating a proper intermarriage ceremony, so to speak. And he goes through different, you know, models of non-Jews who were sort of embraced by Jewish society, Ger Toshav, Yirei Hashem. And he goes on to say that there really isn't any halachic precedent for a framework of intermarriage, but times are different, and maybe we should look at these models, even if they don't halachically apply, and try to sort of, you know, co-opt them. So that argument is being made in certain circles of the, you know, more left wing side, I guess, of conservative Judaism. But again, you know, I note that, you know, it's not like the problem of intermarriage only came up in, you know, 1950 or 1960 in America, but it's something that was discussed all throughout Jewish history in the Tanakh, in the Gemara, something that came up in the Middle Ages as well. And Poskim never sort of, you know, went to accommodate this. I think before I go on to just some of the Orthodox reactions to the Pew report, I think one thing that is worth noting is that while it might be that back in the day, choosing to intermarry could be seen as a statement that you're really not connected to Jewish people, that you're rejecting Judaism. Anecdotally, I don't think that's as true today. On the one hand, I think that's very encouraging that, you know, even those who might make this choice that could be seen as you know, very problematic, you know, we could argue that maybe it's not as catastrophic as maybe it would have been in some ways, because some people who are interdating or intermarrying, you know, still feel connection to Judaism. But at the same time, there is something tragic that, you know, it used to be that going to Jewish day school or Jewish camp meant that you would marry Jewish. At the same time, that's not true today. And again, in some ways, you know, it's good to know that that some who are choosing to do that still want to stay connected to Judaism. But at the same time, a little bit concerning also that that norm has sort of you know, that sort of norm has broken down, despite, especially in the conservative movement, a lot of concern being raised, you know, in my youth about the prospects of intermarriage. But again, this, you know, this goes back to, you know, what I said about, you know, going to college, that at a certain point when you're just that integrated into society and you're willing to socialize and be with anybody. So that's obviously what's going to happen, is you're just going to, young people will fall in love with whoever they fall in love with. And as on the ground, it's just become, you know, more of a reality. So even among those who are more committed, it's just sort of become accepted. And people will figure it out. Perhaps some of these families, will provide their kids with some sort of Jewish education, but still obviously not the same. I just want to conclude with some of the Orthodox reactions to the Pew report. And these appeared in Jewish Action magazine about 6 years ago. And I think it's worth seeing these voices, because I think, for a while, the reaction to intermarriage would have just been, okay, that's the problem of those who are choosing not to keep halacha, not those who are choosing to distance themselves from Judaism, but look at, you know, the Orthodox numbers, 98% are marrying Jewish. That's wonderful. But I think it's worth seeing these approaches. So Rabbi Stephen Weil writes, he says, that statistic should make us feel deeply distressed. Are we not our brother's keepers? Okay, that's what Rabbi Weil writes. Dr. Erica Brown writes, we need to learn more about the American Jewish community at large and ask what we can do to strengthen in-marriage, community building, and Jewish education for those who do not share our denominational commitment, precisely because we are the best equipped to doing so. We have richer and better Jewish education than the overwhelming majority of American Jews. We have tight-knit synagogues that take prayer, Israel, and Jewish identity seriously. We shine at building communities based on chesed and responsibility. We invest in Jewish education on every level. Virtually every aspect of neglect and loss that not surprisingly surfaced in the peer report has not impacted the Orthodox community. Okay? So anyway, we're seeing a theme here of taking responsibility for the situation, not just letting it happen and saying it's not our problem, but saying, you know, maybe we have something to offer. It should at least bother us. Rabbi Avram Goldberg uses this as a call towards Kiruv, and not just for rabbis to do Kiruv or professional Kiruv people, but more interaction between observant and non-observant families to bring a love of Yiddishkeit. And finally, Rabbi J.J. Schachter saying that, yes, while our intermarriage rates are very low, it graphically highlights just how much we have failed to meaningfully engage and impact the broad spectrum of Achenu B'nai Yisrael in this country. And just to sort of piggyback on that, so Rabbi J. David Bleich is a Rosh Kol at Yeshiva University and a brilliant halachic thinker. So already back in 1981, I think in one of the first Journal of Halachic Contemporary Society journals, so he discussed how, so if we go back to that source in Nehemiah that talked about, where they sort of excoriated people to get back to in-marriage and to stop the intermarriage that was happening in their time. So he notes that the discussion of keeping Shabbat comes before the discussion of marriage. And the importance of that is that as Dr. Brown was saying, and have, I think really all these individuals are saying here, that at the end of the day, again, while not seen as a guarantee, but really this problem doesn't start with people when they're 20 years old, but the problem begins much younger, and the importance of Jewish education, of Jewish experience, and that's not something that we as Orthodox Jews are supposed to we're not supposed to gloat about the situation, we're not supposed to make it somebody else's problem, but we have to realize that Kol Yisrael Arevim Zeh B'Zeh, and it's something that should concern all of us. So I think we've seen how this has really played out throughout Jewish history, all the way starting from Bereishit, but hopefully an awareness of what's going on, to whatever extent possible, will help the discourse continue in the direction of Avraham Avinu, of Rivka Yemenu, and ensuring a strong future for the Jewish people.